In meinem Podcast Kino oder Couch treffe ich jede Woche prominente Menschen aus den unterschiedlichsten Bereichen. Egal, ob aus dem Sport, Musik, Kino, Serien oder Entertainment-Business. Und gemeinsam sprechen wir über spannende Filme, Serien und das Leben. Und es wird die alles entscheidende Frage gestellt, Kino oder Couch? Herzlich willkommen zu einer ganz besonderen Folge von Kino oder Couch. Zum ersten Mal nämlich auf Englisch. We have an amazing guest on the show. He's one part of the most famous twins in the history of film. Next to the twins from Shining. Just kidding. Together with his twin brother, he's been part of one of the most successful movie franchises ever. He became a man on set. He played George Weasley in Harry Potter's 7 movie adventures and mesmerized millions of fans around the world, grown-ups and kids alike. And I have the great pleasure of meeting him and hanging out with him way before he became famous. No. While he was famous, away from magic wands, Hogwarts, and butterbeer. He has a big heart, loves old-timers and chocolate, and devotes a lot of his spare time for charity. Please welcome the one and only Oliver Phelps. Oli.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you. Nice to see you again, or speak to you at the very least.
Exactly. We have to see each other again very soon, but now at least we can listen to each other's voices. Oli.
Yes.
Long time, as you said, no speak. Let's get started with the first question. What is your favorite movie of all time, or the one that is always in your top 10?
I was thinking about this one, and there's like two different versions. There's like, if I'm just looking for like a sit down, watch it and enjoy it film.
Yeah.
Mission Impossible 2, just because as action films go, it's got everything. It's got needless explosions. It's got a semi-believable plot. Great camera work.
A semi-believable plot. I like that.
Yeah, or another go-to is The Wolf of Wall Street. I think it's just absolutely
okay, but
fantastic.
But let's talk about Mission MI2, because that's the one that John Woo did. That's back in the year 2000. That's two decades gone.
Yeah, long time ago.
I remember that I saw the first one, the first MI movie, Mission Impossible, and I did like it. I wasn't really intrigued by it, but the second one was exactly what I expected it to be, especially from an action movie. What did you like about it?
I think it's just that it is just an action movie. Obviously, you've got the effects and everything what goes with it as well. But I just think it was very, it just kind of drew you in. There was so much what went along, even though you're watching it and you're thinking, why is the bad guy going on a motorbike after the main protagonist? I don't quite get that. And then, but then you just roll with it. And it's, I think, you know, it's, there's a lot of things that go with it as well. The music in it was very good. Metallica, it was the first song they ever did. A theme tune to a movie too. And I think it may be as well, I think it was one of the first DVDs I ever owned.
Really?
And I think that may be why. Yeah. So I think that may be why it's still embedded in my mind, because I still remember like the title sequence, what you get when you start a DVD up, and it had like the behind the scenes, like showing them filming around Sydney and things like that.
No, and what I did like about the movie is especially the opening sequence when he's basically hanging between those two mountaintops. That's the one, isn't it?
That's the one. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and then,
that's the one. Yeah,
you know, the motorcycle fight where they basically drive towards each other and then jump off and hit each other in midair, and the typical John Woo standoff. I did like it as well, and I think actually, you know, in comparison to some other movie franchises, not Harry Potter, but it's getting better, you know, with every movie that comes along.
Yeah, it seems to be. I think because it sticks to that narrative, it is an action film, and that's kind of what.
And it doesn't add anything else to it. Yeah.
No, exactly, and I think that's what sometimes you don't, you know, you watch those films because you know what you're going to be getting, and that's not a bad thing at all. Is seeing the car chases, seeing the explosions, seeing the high stunts, and so actually I was speaking with a friend of mine who's working on the latest one at the moment.
Oh.
And yeah, so I think it seems to have been one of the few productions what's kept going throughout the pandemic last year. And just listening to her talk about it, I was like, go on, ask if there's any little roles going in it. Give us an ask, could you?
Oh, but, that would be so cool, wouldn't it?
It would have been good, but it sounded like they're pretty much done. But
you know that I've been in two Mission Impossible movies.
Have you?
Yes, but I mean, saying that I'm in a movie sounds really cocky, but they put my picture up. I did an interview with Tom Cruise, and I said jokingly to him, you know, if you shoot the next Mission Impossible movie, can I play a dead body or something? He said, no, listen, we're gonna find something really, really cool for you to do. And I said, yes. I mean, you probably say that to everyone. And then I got a call a couple of weeks later from the director, Christopher McQuarrie, and he basically said, Steven, can you take a picture of you, because we want to put it up in one of those gadgets that we use them. I don't know, was it 5 or 4 or 6, I don't know. And then my management called me because she saw the trailer, the world trailer for MI5, I think, Phantom Protocol. And she said that I was in it. Rogue Nation. That's the one. That I was in. And then I was in this in the following Mission Impossible movie as well. So that is my little enjoyable story about it.
I need to get this out to everyone. I did not tell you that I was going to mention Mission Impossible before we recorded.
Yeah, exactly. That is just
amazing info to pick up from.
Yeah, but I can tell you another story about Mission Impossible 2, because I did the premiere for that movie, and it was in Cologne, and it was on Tom Cruise's birthday. And I remember that I spoke to my producer and I said, listen, I mean, if it's his birthday, we need to give him a birthday cake. So we went to this really great bakery store and ordered a cake that depicted him hanging between those two mountains. So it was made out of marzipan, chocolate and everything. And you could see a little Tom Cruise figure hanging between two mountains. And I brought it into the movie theater, and Tom Cruise Cruise's management came up to me and said, Steven, what do you want to do with that cake? And I said, it's Tom Cruise's birthday. I want to give him a birthday cake. And they said, he doesn't like birthday cakes. And I'm like, what? Who doesn't like birthday cakes? So I went on stage anyways, and the whole movie theater sang Happy Birthday, Tom Cruise. And then I gave him the cake, and I think he liked it. I don't know if he threw it away straight afterwards, but I think he liked it.
I'm sure he would have enjoyed the sentiment at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. I think you need to do that. Okay, so exactly. Mission Impossible 2, perfectly fine. I think it's a great movie. I think it's a great action movie. And just because you said it, I'm going to go and watch all of them again. And I can't wait. I think, did your friend tell you that, are they shooting the new ones back to back?
I'm not too sure. I know they've been on it for a bit of a while now.
But so they shot it in London. Where did they shoot it?
They were filming this part just outside of London, because I think it's based at the London studios.
Okay,
but I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you. I just know that they've been working on it for quite a while.
Okay, and the second movie is?
And the second movie was The Wolf of Wall Street. Oh.
I mean, that's
purely because I remember reading the book, Jordan Belfort's book, which is kind of a much longer story than the film, even though it's quite a long film. But the way they were able to rework it into a cinematic piece, I thought was fantastic. And just in terms of the acting, I think just the balls behind it, I think is just absolutely brilliant to watch. And it's a film I've watched probably close to a dozen times or so. If you think it hasn't been out that long to watch a dozen times, I suppose. But no, it's
8 years old. I think, yeah, exactly.
Is it that long now?
Yeah, it's 8 years.
Oh gosh, all right.
And what? To be honest, I mean, the casting is amazing. You know, next to Leo, Jonah Hill, Margot Robbie, Matthew McConaughey. I mean, there's so many great actors in it. And to be honest, I don't know if you think about it the same way. I think that Leonardo DiCaprio would have deserved the Oscar for The Wolf of Wall Street. I think it was better than in The Revenant.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree with you. Completely agree. Actually, because I'm a member at BAFTA, and I remember I voted for him for the best actor from that on that year, definitely, because I think his performance had everything, really. It was very, very believable, first and foremost, and it just cemented what an icon he is of the cinematic age.
Is there one scene that stuck to your mind why you liked that movie so much?
I think if I had to think of one, it's the one when the I'm not leaving scene. when he's basically, you think he's going to walk away.
The office.
Get it within the office, and everyone starts doing the and everyone starts doing that, and I think just that type of thing, because there's no fancy tricks to it. It's just someone giving a speech, but you can kind of see the journey of the scene. It starts off with him almost admitting with his dad, okay, I'm walking away now, and then reading the room, and then going back from, actually no, this is, I built this and I'm staying there. So I think that's almost the go-to scene, I think, what a lot of people think when they think of that film. That may be one of them anyway.
Yeah, I think that is one of the great scenes. The other one is when he hallucinates about his car. You know, when he, I don't know, is it a Lamborghini or a Ferrari? You know, and he thought that he parked it perfectly. And he wakes up in the morning, walks outside and takes a look at the car. I thought that was so fun. I thought it was so freaking funny. I thought it was amazing what he did. I mean, I have to watch that movie again, because I only saw it twice in preparation for the red carpet at the Oscars. And I just thought he was, I think it really turned out that to be the perfect role for Leo, because he could be arrogant, sentimental, thoughtful, nice, really mean, motivational. I think he did everything within that character that, you know, his acting chops were right on the scene. And I think Martin Scorsese, who directed the movie, did a perfect job in giving him the freedom to do anything that he wanted to do with that role.
Yes. Yeah, it was. It really was.
Is that something as an actor that you look at and basically say, oh, I would have loved to be a part of that movie as well, or to play Leo? I mean, is that like a dream come true role that you would love to have been, you know, have taken?
I think certainly to be involved in something like that would be the, I suppose, like any actor really, that's what you want to be involved in, is the big iconic films really, where as soon as you mention it, even maybe non cinema goers, like people who go regularly, a lot of people, if you mention a film like that, they know exactly what it is you're talking about. And I think as well, because it's, you know, it's semi-biographical as well, so there is an element of truth to it, so you're portraying a certain person as well. I think there's always something like that would be definitely good to be able to do.
But wouldn't you say that being a part of something like Harry Potter is so iconic, and it would be, you know, a part of movie history for generations to come? I mean, this is something that people will always look at, you know, to see the magical world in a completely different light, and especially with all the different characters. I mean, you and your brother, you know, Hermione, you know, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint. I mean, there's so many amazing, Neville. I mean, there's so many amazing characters. Do you look back at it and basically say, wow, I mean, that has been my home run so far? I mean, there could be many more to come.
I think so. I think it's because it's always been in my, since I was 14. So we got cast when we were 14 in the films. And I suppose because it's always been a present, as it were, be it we're filming it or that it's just part now of, it's pretty much part of history from where we are. Like, people are brought up with it. We're meeting new people all the time who are who weren't even born, whose parents probably weren't even together when the last movie came out. Mm-hmm. Yet they know who the characters are, they know everything about it. And it's quite sweet seeing that side of it. I was out in my car actually yesterday. So we've just started to have a nice couple of days of weather here in England. And I've got an old English sports car, a Morgan. So it's like a little two-seater. And I was out for a drive in it, and I was stuck in some traffic, and there was a guy crossing the road with his mum, and he's probably about 10 or 11. So I just like waved him across, and I heard him just say, "Is that one of the twins from Harry Potter?" "I think it is. I think," like, he was going like, and his mum was like, "No, nah, why would he be around here?" And it was quite funny just seeing that that reaction, because that stuff like that never gets old to me. It's always really cool. And I think being able to have been played a good guy as well, that almost makes you a bit more endearing to the fan base, and maybe playing the characters who, certainly with the books as well, that kind of like backed it up, that they were the jokers, the lighthearted, the comic relief side of it. So you're always onto a bit of a winner, I think, when you play a goodie anyway. But yeah, it is just such a big part of so many people's lives, and it's quite a, it still blows me away, and it's quite funny. You know, there's certain friends of mine who've still not seen the movies.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They tell me they haven't seen it, and they just
secretly they didn't. They just don't want to say it. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe they have. But like a friend of mine who came with us to two of the promotional trips, he'd never seen the films, and by the end of it, he was like, we went to a premiere in Sweden, I think it was, and somebody asked for his autograph. And he just signed it, and they said, "Oh, I need to have a character. What character can I say I played?" And someone said, "Oh, are you Stan Shuntspike, who's the bus driver?" And for those of you who aren't too aware, like, the bus driver is this really old man, and Lee was in his late 20s at the time. He had no idea who this guy was. He said, "Yeah, I was that guy." And it was only after he watched the films a couple of years later, he said, "Hang, why was I telling everyone I was this bus driver?" But you know, I was always happy to watch him say that. I thought, well, do your homework. But it is quite funny, especially when there's like my godson, who's 8 years old now. And for many years, he was never really, didn't really understand anything to do with the films. And then gradually at school, they obviously started reading at least the first book. And he told his class, "Oh yeah, my godfather is George Weasley." And of course, people are pulling his leg, like, "Yeah, okay, sure it is. So I did a little video for him. And
you should have just shown up at the school. You know, yeah, walking into the classroom, basically saying, "Hey, where's my godson? Ah, there you are. I just want to say hi," and then walk out.
Yeah, exactly. That probably would be better next time around. But it's quite, as I say, but again, like, he wasn't born when the last film came out, and yet he could tell you different spells. He could tell you all the houses, all the characters. Cool. And it is really sweet and special that there's not many films where it does retain itself. It does keep, well, I'd say it doesn't just retain it. It gets bigger because there's more people who are aware of it.
It's an interesting fact that you're talking about it that way, because I think the only other franchise that has the same magic to us is Star Wars. You know, there's so many kids out there who play with Lego Star Wars sets and know all the characters' names, but they've never seen one of the movies. It's interesting, you know, that you know, you can talk to them about, you know, Chewbacca, Han Solo, Luke Skywalker. They know everything, but they haven't seen the movie. And I think that's the great thing about Harry Potter as well, because it's something that, you know, parents can watch with their kids, or parents can just watch it by themselves. It's a date movie, or kids can go there. I think that's the great thing about this magical world that has been created. Ollie, before we dive deeper into that whole thing, into amazing career, there's one more question that I have. You know, we were talking about your two favorite movies. What about series? Is that like a favorite series that you've binge watched in the past couple of weeks, years, months?
Yeah. There's again, it depends what mood. There's a comedy series. There's a British one called Men Behaving Badly, which is just very, it's like mid 90s or 90s, I suppose it was made. But as comedy goes, it's just slapstick, very, very funny. And I binge watched all six seasons of that a couple of weeks ago, actually. And that was
Is it very British, humor-wise?
I suppose, in a sense, it's these two chaps who live together, who just drink lager all day, and just talk as guys would. The one's got a stable girlfriend, and the other one, his girlfriend's very, not in control, but very strong-minded woman. And his other housemate is obsessed with the girl who lives upstairs. And it's like, are they, aren't they, going to ever get together type thing. So, but to watch it, I remember, I think going back to, although some of the themes in it are quite adult, I remember watching it when I was probably about 14, 15 years old with my grandparents, and laughing at it then. So there is a bit of a sentimental side to it as well. But on the other flip side of that is I just finished binge watching all the seasons of The Sopranos as well, probably about a year ago now. And that was great, although we were having an extension built at our house, and it went to appeal because of the planning. Someone at the council said no, so I had to go to an appeal. And you can't be, the law in England is you can't be in the house or on the property when the appeal the person from the council comes just to survey, the surveyor comes around, you can't be there.
Okay.
And because I've been watching this, you know, intensely The Sopranos, I was saying to my wife, well, maybe we should just leave like a little brown envelope in the back garden. And she was like, the real world doesn't work like this. You can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, The Sopranos basically was like, I think the first TV series that really made people binge watch something in a sense, you know, in comparison to Emergency Room. I think that was something that you kind of grew with the family of The Sopranos and James Gandolfini. For over 8 years, you know, at the end of the, I think 1999 and then to the mid 2000s. I think it was brilliant. I think brilliant acting, especially, I spoke to someone else about The Sopranos, James Gandolfini. He was such a sweet person, I think, in real life. I mean, really sad that he died a couple of years ago. But in that whole word, the way that he treated other people and how he sort of did his business is still impressive.
And as you say, I think it's just the, as you watch it, you see the progression of all the characters, not just Tony Soprano, but obviously the whole, his family. He's got a relationship with his mother in the early seasons, the other family members who drift in, who come in and out of the season, problems with the law, and obviously the other families as well in New York. And it's, I think as you watch it, it's, you kind of take for granted really how easy it is just to access it now. Whereas at the time, certainly in the later seasons, there was quite big gaps in between the seasons coming out. Mm. So you suddenly go from say one season to the next, and I suppose you notice it more with the children, but they're suddenly a lot older.
Yep.
And you notice that side of it. So, but it, again, watching it is just, I think the way it was shot, it was absolutely, absolutely superb.
Is that something that your wife enjoys as well? Is that a series that you watch all by yourself?
No, yeah, I kind of watch that by myself. She's not really into that type of, well, I say she's not into that type of thing. She watches quite dark, gritty
thriller series.
Stuff like that. Yeah, kind of, but not, nothing like that and Broadwalk Empire I watch quite a lot of, and she's not really into that type of thing. But yeah, we'll watch, as I say, like The Men Behaving Badly, we watched that together, and she enjoys that as well.
What would you say, are you rather team cinema or team couch? Is it difficult for you to go to the movies?
Not really, no. No. I mean, I'm spoiled. As I said, being a member at BAFTA, I kind of get sent through in December and into January, pretty much all the main tempo films from the different studios. So I've got like a cool little cinema setup at my house, actually. So I
can, oh, nice.
So I, as I said, when I was building this extension I was on about, I had I wanted to make sure that this room was like with surround sound and decent projector and big screen and everything to watch it on. So it's been really cool being able to settle down and just watch it on a 4 meter wide screen.
That is larger than some of the cinema screens in Germany.
Yeah. There are some times I think, did I build this too big? But at the same time, because I was finding that there was, when I was just watching these films on a TV screen, you really don't get the same sense of scope and the sound as when you are seeing it in a cinema, like Le Mans, for example, yes. Like that film.
Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
And Matt Damon. I mean, the sound on that is just absolutely brilliant. But also because Christian Bale's character is from the part of England where I'm from, a lot of the, just like the way he spoke and some of the slang sayings that he used, I don't suppose not a lot of people watching would understand what he was saying or see the significance of it, but I was watching it saying, oh no, I can't believe they said that bit, because it's so specific to where we live. Like if you're just not having a disagreement, but you're just not agreeing on something, you're just talking. There's a saying around here called, well, let's not go around the Reekin, and Christian Bale's character says that. Now the Reekin is a big hill over in the over the other side of the city, and that's where that comes from, you know, back in the olden days, let's not keep walking around this big hill is basically where it means. And his character says it in the film, and I was like, that is brilliant, like that level to detail, which is so well, I suppose, researched as well. And I think there's a scene as well when they get to Le Mans and it looks like really weathery. And again, Christian Bale says, oh, it's wet over, it looks wet over Bill's mother's, which again is a Birmingham expression, meaning it's wet over Stratford-upon-Avon way, which is Bill being Bill Shakespeare, William Shakespeare. So that's kind of where that comes from. But again, unless you lived here, you'd not have any idea what the significance of that was. So again, watching films like that in a bit, in a nice film environment, I think is very, very special to do.
And it's a lot of fun. But did he do a good job regarding the accent?
I thought so, yeah. Yeah, I really did. I really did. I think he got my vote for best supporting actor, actually.
Oh, okay. At the BAFTAs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he is a brilliant actor, but, you know, sometimes, I mean, that's difficult because in Germany, everything is dubbed. I mean, I like to watch the original version because, you know, a lot of the details go missing. I didn't know about, you know, the figure of speech of Christian Bale's character and especially the Birmingham accent. I didn't know that. Yeah. So that's interesting.
Which I don't know if that would even translate.
Into German? No, definitely not. Yeah.
You know, yeah,
definitely not. But you know, it makes it so much more fun to watch a movie. And I mean, we've seen a couple of really awful accents in the past. I think that always. I don't know if that does that put you off when you watch a movie and it you know, and they have a really bad accent, even though they should have.
I think sometimes if you hear whatever accent is, you think, why bother? Like, just do it, and why make the character like that? Because it's. I can't remember one exact figure, but I can remember watching a film just thinking, this is just, I think it was an American girl trying to play an English character, and it was over the top posh.
And it was not really good.
And the character wasn't posh or anything like that. And it's like, why would you even, why do that? So again, it's just, I think that can be quite a distraction, but luckily I think there's so much more people who are really, really hot on accents as well now that it's quite, it does blend in quite well a lot. But I suppose with the film released in Germany, as you say, I suppose a lot of it gets, all that gets lost, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's sad on one hand. I think on the other hand, it's very important to the movie business in Germany because there's so many people, especially actors and actresses, who depend on that type of work, you know, next to the movies that they shoot or series. And they sometimes do a really, really good job. Sometimes it really sucks. But, you know, it's the same thing with the original version. No, but because I know why I'm talking about this, because I just spoke in the movie show that I do about a movie called White Mountain Time. Have you heard about that one?
No, I haven't, no.
With Emily Blunt and Jamie Dornan. And I just read a couple of things on the internet about Jamie Dornan's accent. And they said it was so appalling, so bad, that a lot of people weren't able to watch the movie, even though I think he is, I don't know, is he Scottish? Irish. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, he's Irish. Yeah. And he was supposed to have this really special Irish accent, and people have been watching it and they said it was appalling and it was really bad and it put them off watching that movie. I mean, the movie is really weird as well, but you know, an actor of his caliber with a bad accent makes an even worse movie experience. And I thought it was funny to listen to that.
Right. I'm not too sure. I haven't seen it, so I wouldn't be able to.
Don't go and see it. It's not worth it. No. It's not worth it spending time in your own movie theater. But is there something that is very important for you to have when you watch a movie at home in your little movie theater? Chocolate, sweets, chips, I don't know. Or do you sit down and basically have a glass of wine or nothing at all to take your attention away?
It depends, really. I mean, sometimes it's sometimes I'll have a glass of drink or something like that to watch it with, or it really varies, to be honest with you. There's no like set routine I'll go through, apart from sometimes when there are a lot of films coming through in the voting season, then I'll I kind of give it half an hour, and if the film's not going anywhere, I'll get rid of it, because I've wasted many hours watching just rubbish.
Interesting. That's what I started to do as well. You know, a couple of years ago, I would watch every movie to the end, because I thought, you know, someone has put so much work into it. I want to give them the credit. Maybe the last 5 minutes of the movie will be great. And now I'm basically the same as you are. I watch something for 30 minutes, and if it doesn't catch me, if there's nothing that I can see in the movie that would be good, I have to turn it off, because otherwise I'm going to go crazy.
Yeah, I think that's it. And especially when there's so much choice around as well. Yep. Sometimes it can put you in a better, it can put you in the wrong mood, really, if you're watching just something that's not supposed to be there, or, you know, you wouldn't necessarily, you're not really engaging with. But no, I mean, in terms of actually doing any, like actually watching anything or anything like that, no, I just like to, I normally find that I respond better to films later in the day. Yeah. Like in the evening time or something like that. I think that sometimes you've got so many other distractions going on. But I mean, another golden rule is I always have to make sure the phone is either off or in a different room when I'm watching something, so there's no distraction, because I think we're all guilty of watching something on the TV or something, and before you know it, you've been browsing at God knows what on Amazon or something like that. What's happened with the plot line? So I make sure that if I'm really trying to get invested in something, I'll try and leave any distractions out of the way.
No, and especially, why bother? You know, if you are distracted by a phone, why bother and watch a movie? You know, rather do one or the other instead of doing both at the same time. It doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
Ollie, I would like to jump back, because we've been talking about Harry Potter just a little bit, and hopefully you're fine, because there are a couple of questions still on my mind. You know, back at the age of 14, when you and your brother went to that casting, did you both know what you were up to? I mean, did you go there because you had read the books prior to the casting, or you were just called, or was it, we need twins to show up? I mean, how did you sort of get that casting call, and with what kind of preparation did you go there?
Well, I'd read the first three books, and the fourth book had or was just about to be released, or it was in the offing anyway, the fourth book was. And basically a friend of my mum got in touch with her and just said, you know, that look, they're casting for the Harry Potter film. It's a totally open audition, anyone can go for it. And they're casting for twins. So my mum knew this lady through a charity organization that we used to go to called the Twins and Multiple Births Association. So it's kind of like from birth, really, like, so families can get advice and support and stuff like that for people who've had multiple births, like twins or triplets or more so. So you'd have like days out and things like that. So it was really through a contact there who was made aware that they were casting for twins.
So there's a gathering of triplets and twins. In Birmingham.
That is, yeah. It's countrywide. I think they changed the name of it recently for some reason. But anyway, it was always Tambor when we used to be involved. So it was really good, actually, because obviously being a twin and being gay, although I hate that word when people refer to me as the twin, I hate that word. It's almost
what,
a bit
what
like,
would you rather have people say?
I suppose just saying, how's your brother? Or something like that. I think that's the other side to it, you know, because otherwise it's a bit more of a, oh, you're different, you're odd. Yeah. I always see it as that way, you know. So it was quite interesting being able to go through that. But literally because this lady had her ear to the ground in terms of castings for twin roles, we got the call through that, and we were able to set it up. And we went to a open audition in Leeds, and there was, as I said, open audition, so there was every role going, and we were very green when we went to the audition, because we got there and there was thousands of people there.
Wow.
And I'm not exaggerating, like literally over 1,000 people there. And we soon realized that we were the only set of twins there who weren't in the same clothing, which again just shows our naivety, because I suppose if you're going for identical roles, you should try and look the same. And we got a raffle ticket which told you when you would be seen by the casting director, and they were on number, say, I don't know, 15, and we were number 600 and something. So we knew we had some time to wait. So we went to a department store over the road and bought matching shirts, and then just hung around practiced
it. Well, because you thought you needed matching shirts because it would be important.
Yeah,
for the
I think because we saw every other set of twin there, and there was quite a few. Every other set of twin there was in the exact same clothing, and then thinking more about it, like, well, Fred and George are very similar, certainly in those books what come out at the time, like they were known for tricking their parents and stuff as to who was who. So we thought, well, let's just, we should probably do that. So we did that, and then after quite a while waiting, we ended up going into to see the main casting director, who coincidentally was in the room that we went into. As we were waiting in the line to go into the rooms, there was the room opposite had just opened up, and a young girl put her head around the door and said, who's next? But because we were already lined up to this room to our left, and there was no reason, and for some reason my brother and I agreed on it, which is quite rare anyway, that we'd go in this one room. And luckily we did, because the room opposite what opened up, she was the assistant casting director, and the room we went into was Janet Hutchison, who was the head casting director. So you never know, if we went in the other room, she may have seen us and said, nah, it's not really what I'm thinking of, or not worth passing those notes over to Janet. Yeah, Janet, who's making the big call, saw it, and she said we had the look from the moment she saw us, even though our hair color was different than Fred and George, but that was about it. And I remember,
what did you have to do, just walk into the room and show yourself, or did you have to read lines?
So they gave everybody one line, which was it was literally like a sentence, which was one of Harry's lines. So no matter what character you were going for, you read that one line. And we went in, and yeah, you pretty much just had to say it one line each, I think it was. We were probably in there for I can't actually remember. I remember going in and thinking I was going to fall over with fright, just how nervous I was at the whole thing. But at the same time, we were just very much, we kind of tried to come off a bit more relaxed and just like, well, we're here now, let's just say our piece, and off we went. But I remember afterwards we walked out, and it was the first time we'd actually seen like the show mom. You see like people's parents like really pushing them, you know, oh no, you need to see my daughter again, she didn't do it very well. And they're like, sorry, you only get one go, you know. And we were walking around just going, are people actually like this? Like, we were still very green to it. And then they said to us, oh, can you have you got your headshot? And we don't. So these are the days of Polaroid cameras, before digital cameras or anything like that. So we had to go and get a Polaroid taken. And then that's all we did. And as we left, we thought, well, at the very worst, we had a day away, and that's it. And we stopped for a pub lunch on the way home, and that was it. Very I remember nice. I love pub lunches. Really, really clean. Yeah, it was a nice evening. Yeah.
Who wanted? I mean, who was pushing for it more? You or your brother?
I think we both wanted it, in terms of it was something different, and it was. I think that was probably just it. It was something different, and why not? We always used to, as kids, we used to do little shows for our mum and dad, you know, like miming songs or miming dialogue or something like that every now and then. Probably used to drive my dad nuts because it would drag him away from watching the football on the TV. but we'd do that. So
that's
always
what kids do.
Exactly. So we did always have this slight... This performer in us, but funny enough, the week after, or the week before we went for the audition, one of the two, the drama teacher at school, because at that time in your school life, in England, you have to choose your GCSEs, so what subjects you're going to specialise in for the exams 2 years later, and the drama teacher said, "Oh, I wouldn't bother doing it if I were you." So I love.
Well, really? There was no talent in both of you.
Pretty much, yeah, which I love now to remind anyone who will listen, don't listen to people who tell you can't do something, especially when it's just based on their single opinion.
The funny thing, Ollie, is that the same happened to me. I went for an audition for MTV for the London-based office a long time ago, and the casting director said, Steve, you're a really nice guy, but, you know, you will never end up in front of the camera. Maybe I shouldn't have, but I've been doing it since then for the past, over 25 years, and I still enjoy it. So I totally agree. If you want to do something, you know, do it with passion, empathy, and dedication, and I think at the end it works out.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it took some time to actually use that as fuel for me more than anything. Like I still remind myself of that now, that one person who just wants to, for no nobody's, it wasn't like he was gaining anything from telling me no.
No, and especially why? And especially why?
Well, that's it. Exactly, exactly. So I make sure that if anyone ever says, oh, yeah, like, you know, your school did this, I was like, they didn't do it for me. And, you know, so I, and that's a good thing. I remember speaking to Alfonso Cuarón about it. And he just laughed. He said, oh, yeah, you don't need to listen to the people like that. And
Alfonso Cuarón, see?
Yeah, yeah. So he did the, so he directed the third movie. And he just, what film had he just finished doing at the time?
Well, that's a good question.
Oh, I can't remember now. But it's a huge acclaim at the time. And I remember him just saying to me, like, no, just you believe in you, you're good enough, just do it. If you think you're good enough at something, stick to it. And I always think that's a very powerful message to stick to. And as you say, do it with passion, do it with empathy, and just keep at it. But yeah, going back to your question. So we went along to the callbacks, and
I know which movie. Sorry, was it Y Tu Mama También, Lust for Life? Was that the one that he did just prior to Harry Potter?
I'm cheating. I've got a computer in front of me. It was.
Because Gravity was along a lot later.
It was, yeah. I think it was.
Great Expectations.
No, he did. Maybe it wasn't, yeah.
But yes, he's a great director.
It would be, yeah. He did that. He did Gravity, Roma. Obviously, Children of Men was after when we filmed. But he was, I mean, to us, he was good, because I remember we had a meeting with him just before we started filming, and he wanted to gauge how we did the characters. Mm-hmm. I remember going into meet with him thinking, are we getting recast here? And then, because with the first two movies were done by Chris Columbus, and then so getting a new director in, you think, oh, maybe it's almost like a new manager comes into a football team, you know, or he's going to get some new players in. And he asked us, like, how do you, we're running one of the scenes, and he noticed how James and I were cutting each other up to talk, or doing it very, very quickly. And he said, I like that, keep doing it. So he reworked it, should I say, in the script, where that's why Fred and George in the scene in the third movie where they give Harry the Marauder's map, that's why they're almost finishing each other's sentences off, because that's how we did it. And I suppose if there's any twins listening, they'll probably be aware that happens, I think, because you're always trying to get the word in before your sibling. And that's kind of where that came into it. So it was really, really fascinating that stuff like that kind of just, I suppose, happened by chance, but went down very well with the viewing fan base.
So when you went to that casting after your nice little pub lunch, when did you actually hear about being cast as the Weasley twins? I mean, did it take a long time? I mean, where were you and what did you think?
Yeah, we were. So it kind of went, we went back to studios for about three or four more callbacks after that, where we were with, again, with Janet Hutcherson, but also Chris Columbus was involved at that point as well. And I remember in one of the final auditions, it wasn't the screen test, it was maybe in the one before that. And I remember there was a set of twins in the waiting room before that who were the most obnoxious people I've ever seen.
In what way?
Just like, you know, oh, we've got this part, you know, like openly telling anyone there, you shouldn't bother being there type thing. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm probably more confident now, I'd have a word with them. But at the time I kind of just sat still. But I remember in my head thinking, I don't want it just for me now. I want it so you don't. And that was my drive. So we went into it and we were just, I kind of walked away from that audition thinking, we've got this. We're definitely the ones for it.
Really?
But then there's a car. Yeah, I don't know why. I had nothing to base it on. But
because
I just
it went well, or the reaction of the casting people, or the people around you.
I think both. Everything just worked. We practiced it beforehand. Everything worked well. We got a good laugh when we needed the laugh, and I kind of just walked away. Yeah, we've got this. But then the runner who saw us out was an American girl, and she said, "Okay, have a nice life."
Oh,
and we were like, what is that? Well, as in, well, we'll never see you again. Okay. So we kind of went home thinking, oh, well, that's that. And then we got a call a couple of days later. We were away on holiday. We were in Crete or Corfu or one of the islands there. And we got a call saying, oh, when you get home off your holiday, we'd like to see you for a screen test. So obviously, I think this was on the second day of the holiday. So obviously you don't see that many redheads with tans. So we were literally living under the parasol, factor 70. I think we came back paler than we did going. And we went to the screen test, and it was obviously on a set for the first time with the crew, with the camera, with being mic'd up, and they put like this really, I thought it looked terrible, like a sprayed ginger in our hair.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, this doesn't look ginger at all. It looks really, anyway, so I just thought, okay. Cause they did say beforehand, would you be open to having your hair dyed? And we said, yeah, that's, doesn't really,
it's like the least of your problems. You just want to start the job.
I mean, I thought I'm not going to look at it. It doesn't really bother me. And I remember when we were doing the screen test, Chris Columbus said, so who wins out of fights between you guys? I think he was just thinking in terms of, you know, sibling squabbles and stuff. And James said, well, I do sometimes. I've got a good uppercut, but Oliver's got a bit of a jab, which got all the crew laughing, which obviously we were being quite tongue-in-cheek by it, but I think that just re-emphasized that we were kind of good, right for the part in terms of the joking characters. And then the next that we went home, that was it. I remember it being my dad's birthday, and we drove home that night, and then probably the next day, the next evening, we got a phone call, and my mum answered it, and the cast, it was Janet, the casting director, saying, hi, is that the mum of Fred and George Weasley? Oh. And that was kind of how we found out. And it was just, as I say, I kind of thought that we'd already got the role. I thought we were just going through the protocol. I was convinced that we were going to get it. It was almost a bit like that. The Truman Show had not long come out in cinema at the time. And I remember thinking it's almost like someone's watching what I'm doing and setting me up for this amazing journey to go on. So I was kind of like, yeah, this is going to happen. Again, being green to it and just being green to the level of interest, the amount of competition involved. But yeah, so we literally did that. And within a week or so, we were on set.
Oh my goodness. But maybe that was your superpower, being green, you know?
I think so. I think it was. I think because that way when you've got nothing to worry about or fear, you're okay with it. You know, it's, it was very much a case of, well, let's just go with it. And I always remember we got they gave us some, we were on location somewhere, and we were going to, I don't know if we wanted to get a chocolate bar or something. And the accounts department gave us some money out of the petty cash. And I remember taking the change back to them, and they looked at me like I'd gone mad and said, why have you done that? I said, well, it only cost like 50p or whatever it was at the time. And they went,
yeah, but that, I mean, that,
no one does that.
Yeah, but still, I mean, that's, you guys are so sweet and so honest and great. I think you deserve every bit of success that you've had with Harry Potter. But did you ever, I mean, could you have ever imagined, I mean, you knew that you would get the role, but could you have ever imagined how life-changing that whole thing is? Because we're not only talking about a movie and its success all over the world, but we're also talking about the fact that you and your brother grew up with Daniel, with Rupert, with Emma, you know, from the age of 14 up until the age of 24.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I didn't really think about it at all, and I probably still don't too much. It was kind of like, I always see it as it's a job. You know, like that's what you do. Like that's what we did. That was always part of it. I would, for most of the year, I'd be going away. I'd come home most weekends, I suppose. But Sunday night, I'd go down, stay in a hotel, and come back either Friday night or Saturday morning, and that was kind of it. And we'd be filming, doing schoolwork when we're there.
So mostly, did you actually have a couple of teachers on set?
Yeah, so there was some tutors there who probably oversaw probably about six or seven of us at a time. And in hindsight, my if I had any regrets, it would be that I didn't utilize that resource more. Like I did well at the subjects at school that I enjoyed doing, but other subjects I probably could have done a lot better if I'd have just grabbed that. So again, I suppose just life lessons really for anyone listening. Like if you do ever get a chance like that, seize it, use that opportunity,
grab it and go.
Yeah, that's it. That's probably the not. There's not many regrets I have, but that may be one of them. Just because in terms of, I look back thinking, like, I'm a huge history buff, absolutely love it, and just not making the most of that. You know, it was a bit frustrating in hindsight, but you know, it was. I suppose there was a lot of distraction going on at the time as well.
I bet, you know, I've had the great pleasure of being on set doing interviews with you and your co-stars. What was it like? Because as you've been saying it, you were green and that was your superpower. You were determined on getting the job, but you weren't arrogant as some of the others who've been cast in different other movies. And, you know, basically said, we are professional actors and actresses. We're going to get the job done. What was it like on the first day on the set when you met Emma and Rupert and Daniel? Because they weren't all that experienced either. I mean, they did something maybe beforehand, but not on a greater scale. Was that sort of like a welcoming party, a get to know each other party, or did you have to spend time? Did you have to write each other's letters or join a football club and then, I don't know, play together? I don't know. Was there anything to get sort of like the bonding going?
I mean, not really, not that we had, I don't know if anyone in their year group had it type thing. Cause obviously Fred and George played in an older year group than the main trio. But I always remember at when they announced they did a press call with Dan, Rupe and Emma. And this is when we were on holiday and it was in the front page of all the papers, right? This is Harry, Ron and Hermione in the films. And we were looking going, do we look like Rupert? Do we look like him? So we'd already seen them type thing in the press type, you know. And then we had the read through, which is the first time we met anybody who'd been cast, who knew that they'd been, we'd met one of the guys, I think, in the waiting room of one of the auditions, but we didn't know that they were going to go on to be cast. Like they probably didn't know that we would either. And I remember being in doing the read through, and just at the break, actually, they took a break halfway through. And I remember Emma being about, what, she was like 10 or so when she started, or 11 or something. I forget her exact age, but a lot younger than us. But I remember she came over and introduced herself. And that always stands out with me, just like the confidence and the just, that blew me away, that did, actually, because I wouldn't have the nerve to go to anybody and introduce myself. And then, you know, she's there, hello, how are you? And that was really cool. And then in terms of like getting to know Rupe and Dan and people, that just, I suppose stuff like that just happens the more time you spend with people. And a lot of us were staying. So the first couple of months were on locations and a lot of us were staying in the same hotels. So we would socialize, be it in the
parties,
the first
games.
Night. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the first location was in this small little village. So the first thing we filmed was actually the last scene in the movie when they all get on the train to leave Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. And that was our first filming thing. And we were staying at this little, it was almost like a bed and breakfast type thing. But I remember a load of us were downstairs in the lounge area or whatever, and they had a dartboard. And there was quite a few of us playing darts. And that's kind of how we got to talking with each other and knowing each other. So there wasn't, that we experienced anyway, there wasn't like this set team building day or anything like that. It kind of just had a natural progression, really. But it was still really, really nice. And I suppose at the time you don't really appreciate, well, no one knew really that we were going to be spending the next 10 years together. But at the same time,
that's a crazy thought. I mean, you know, you probably don't enter. I mean, I think everyone is sort of thriving for it and looking for a job that, you know, takes you for such a long period of time into different worlds and, you know, brings you fame and fortune. But I don't think anyone has expected what came out of this. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I remember that the first movie came out and I went to see it and I was like, wow, this is really cool because it's so close to the books. And I think it was so refreshing to see all these new faces as the characters that you fell in love with while reading the books. I think there was magic to it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we got the nicest compliment that I got and still get, actually, is people say that we were exactly how they imagined reading the books.
Yeah.
Fred and George to be, or the other characters, we're exactly how they perceived them to be. And to be able to get that response is really nice, because that's always one thing. Although at the time we weren't aware of it, that we could be totally shattering someone's illusion of what Harry Potter is or what Fred and George are.
But that's probably the trust that you put into a casting director as well.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and again, going on to us being green with the whole thing, you don't worry about it, you don't overthink it, and then you kind of learn who the character is yourself. And the good thing is, the go-to is going to the books and being able to read them, and then just almost using those as the characters. But I wouldn't say I did that as often, maybe as I could have done, but I think that's just because we got very confident in what these characters were.
Did you, I mean, speaking of self-confidence, that is something really interesting that I thought about the whole time, because going green into the first movie is completely understandable, but with the success, knowing that the journey would continue, in what way did you approach your characters differently, and especially acting and talking to the directors, because they changed continuously, or the producers? Were you more sure of what you wanted to do?
Yes, I think so. But probably late in the later films, I would ask more, what do you want? And I'm more than happy to be told, can you do it this way? Can you do it that way? So it was more a case of, I always remember that certainly in the last two movies at the very, or three movies at the very least, if there was a scene where I'm supposed to be more upbeat and chirpy, mm-hmm. I would make sure last thing I'd do before I'd, so you'd come out of the dressing room, as it were, and you'd go downstairs, and then you'd walk out a door towards the, so the studios that was used to be a, used to be an old aircraft factory for Rolls-Royce engines. So it's like, you're basically walking across this old, this huge space, which is like an old factory line really, until you go down to the sound stages. And I remember you used to walk out a door, and I remember walking out this door, and my last thing I would do is smile. I'd make sure I'd smile before I opened the door, because that was almost like, right, I'm leaving this door, mm-hmm. the other side of that, I'm in, not in character, well, I suppose, yeah, in character, but I'd be upbeat. So I would be, so the first thing that anyone who didn't see me upstairs in the dressing rooms, they would see me in character. And that's kind of how I would do things, even if there were certain scenes where, I mean, say on the fifth movie, when we were in the room requirements, I remember I'd just broken up with my first long-term girlfriend at the time.
Oh.
And maybe wasn't in the best frame of mind. But I would do that. I got into that type of thing, right? You know, well, no one cares about that. Let's get on to what my job is. I'd smile. I'd get into character before I'd leave the dressing room and go into it like that. So it's quite funny how you can almost put this mask on and just get on with it when you're in a character type thing. Be that cool? Would that be a method way of doing things? I suppose it would be to some degree.
Did it come to you naturally, the acting?
Yeah, I think so. Again, going back to when we were younger, when we used to do performances and stuff like that, James and I, it was almost a case of where that side of things was never an issue. It was more a case of, I think once you're on the set, you've done the hard bit, you've passed the, I always think anyway, you've passed the casting call, you're on there because you're good enough to do it. But it did take some time where, I suppose more so when we finished filming the movies, I would seek out advice, I would seek out acting lessons, I would put the yard in what we didn't do at drama school because we were filming, and try and learn from it, and try and play catch up a lot of the time, because that's kind of where you'd learn your craft. And we did it on the sets, but obviously different people want different things, so being able to provide that,
it's amazing. I think it's so great to listen to all the stuff that you have to say. Are you guys you and your brother stay in contact with the others? I mean, is there like a Harry Potter Telegram group that you write in, or Signal, or WhatsApp?
There's a few of us who still speak fairly regularly. I say fairly regularly, a couple of times.
Who with?
Probably a couple of dozen times a year or so. Like Bonnie, Tom, Rupert.
Tom Felton.
Yeah, Tom's very much keen on keeping everyone in contact with each other. He definitely takes that role, which you probably wouldn't associate with Malfoy to be doing that.
No, I mean, you've been saying that. I mean, you are on the good side. I mean, I think Draco Malfoy and Tom Felton had a difficult time over the past decades, you know, having portrayed that character.
Yeah, exactly. But he's probably the complete opposite to his character in many ways. Like, we went to James, Tom and I went up to Scotland last year to play golf. Rupert was supposed to come with us, but he was called to go and finish doing some filming over in the States, so he couldn't come. So it's just the three of us in the end. And I remember going into this pub just off the 18th green at St Andrews.
And St Andrews,
we go- yeah, yeah. So the home of golf. It was like a golf pilgrimage, as it were. To go,
I know. I went there
it.
As well, to St Andrews.
Oh, brilliant!
I think
great,
2 years ago. Beautiful place. Okay. Beautiful place.
Yes, it really is. And we went into this pub, and we sat down, and it's just so funny seeing some people looking over, like, why are they together?
Exactly. The Weasleys and Malfoy.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be like some people would talk to us and kind of like shun Tom, or they'd talk a lot to Tom and like forget us because they were Slytherins or something. So some people take it quite seriously, but in other ways, we kind of just look at it like we're a group of guys who work together.
Have a great time.
I suppose in your formative years. Yeah, that's it. And just enjoying each other's company. And just because we're all very straight talking with each other, so there's no fluff, but it is very much good fun to be able to still do stuff like that.
Yeah, that's great. It's always a big, I mean, you spend so much time together. It's natural, I think, that you hang out with some people more than the others and, you know, enjoy each other's company. I mean, 10 years is the groundwork for a lot of great friendships, you know? I mean, the time spent is fantastic. Which one out of all the Harry Potter movies is your favorite and why?
I think to watch or that we filmed, would you say?
Oh, that's a good question. To watch and then to have filmed.
I think to watch, I really enjoyed the Deathly Hallows Part One.
Because it's so dark, or that.
Yeah, because of the pace it picks up as well. It doesn't set the scene; it just picks up straight what's going on. So it doesn't tell you who people are. You should know by now. I mean, there's been six films before it. Mm-hmm. You should know who these characters are, and it just jumps straight into it. And it's the first time as well that you see, certainly when my character gets his ear blown off, mm-hmm. and you see this gaping wound and everything, which was actually a lot more tame than the first version that we tested. It made Reservoir Dogs look quite tame.
Really?
Like it was, you know, there was bits of skull hanging on the side of it. There was burnt hair. There was blood everywhere. It looked great. I found a photo of it actually a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking at it going, yeah, I can see why they didn't use it, because I think they said that if they did, the rating would shoot up to at least a 15. So it wouldn't make any sense to do that. So they had to tone it down a bit for the final thing. But again, you see these characters where, going back to like how Fred and George are quite loved characters, and you see them in the firing line. You know, you see that. And I remember watching it thinking that looks really good.
Being part of the action as well, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it. And seeing that side to it. So I enjoyed watching that. I really did when the film came out.
Filming as well? Or is that a different one?
Probably the fourth film for filming. Mike Newell took over as director on that one, and he was very much a case of camaraderie with everybody involved, to the point where we actually had a kitty given to us to pay for taxes if we were going to restaurants or clubs to get home to the hotel or something like that. Like he was very much that side. And the social scene of it, because we'd just turned 18 when we were filming that film. And the social side of it was so much fun, with especially with the new guys coming onto the film, like Robert Pattinson, like Stan and Clemence and Tolga and Katie Leung, and just being able to just hang out with these guys so much. So we'd literally finish filming, on, like, say, the Friday night, we'd have a night out in Watford, the town where we were filming. And then Saturday, we'd normally go in London for a meal and some drinks and stuff. And there was quite a few locations as well, so we'd do the same thing there. And it was so much fun. It was so much fun. And we still talk about those days now. And it does make it really, really special when I think back to, like, there's a scene when we were in Oxford, and it's the scene we were filming was when it's the dance sequence. So McGonagall's teaching the students how to dance. And I remember that scene because we'd all been out the night before, not a few of the guys anyway who were filmed, but those of us who were old enough to go out. I wouldn't say hungover, but just actually, like, you know, because I suppose
excited,
at 18, you can kind of roll out of bed after a night out when you're 18. But yeah, just excited to be there and just making the most of, you know, where we were at that time of our lives, with no commitment, nothing to be, and just getting on and just enjoying it. And I remember just thinking everyone had long hair totally by chance. I remember coming and we all turned up to filming the first day or the read through, and everyone seemed to have really long hair. And I put this down to, for the last 5 years, whatever it was before that, we'd been told how to have our hair, and being suddenly told, if you want to cut it, you can, but no one did.
Oh, okay, because you were 18 and no one could actually really tell you what to do. Is that
I think so, yeah. Oh, okay. I think that was it. Yeah, I was really getting into
rebellious
rock music at the time as well. Like, Birmingham's really is famous for its metal music scene. So I was going to the metal bars where long hair was kind of compulsory. So it was great fun. Maybe not ginger long hair, but I was still accepted by it. But it was great fun. So I watch back and when I see that film, I just think of many good times.
Speaking of good times, I think we need to tell everyone how we met, because that's quite an interesting story as well. I remember you said the year was 2008?
It was 2007. It was 2007. It would be like January, February time.
Yeah, exactly. And we met at the Nuremberg Toy Fair. And it was really interesting because it was all about toys, but they had invited you and your brother, and I think who else was there?
Matt Lewis was there.
Yeah, Matt Lewis was there as well. Neville Longbottom. Yeah, Matt Lewis.
It was the second promotional tour or trip that certainly I had done. We did one to Italy the year before, like the spring before that. But yeah, I remember the publicity girls got in touch and said, do you fancy going over to Germany for, there's this toy fair, and it's just basically talking about the new models it wasn't even toys, it was like models you could buy of Hogwarts and the characters and stuff. And he said, yeah, okay. He said, it's literally a day there. It's a day, an evening's work, but you can go to, we'll put you up in Munich and you can have 2 or 3 days there either side. So like, cool. Okay.
Yeah.
And you can bring a friend along if you want to as well. So we did that.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember that. And then we did the show together, and my hotel was actually in Nuremberg. And then we got talking and you basically said, you know, we're back in Munich. Do you fancy a drink or do you fancy a party? And I said, yes, sure. I know a club. And I remember that we were talking about P1. That was, I don't know, back in the days, that was like one of the hottest clubs in Germany. But I think 2007 was still pretty cool. And I drove with you in a bus to Munich. And I don't recall where I spent the night.
I think, I can't remember actually. I remember we went, because we finished, like, the, in terms of promotional works, it was the easiest evening's work. We literally went to this toy fair, saw all these, in this castle as well, we saw all these really cool products and literally spoke with you on stage for probably 45 minutes or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah, exactly. We just had a good time.
Went back to the, or had a bite to eat or something there, went back to the bus. Being Bavaria, they just filled it with beer and said, okay, we'll see you back in Munich then. Got on this bus back. And I remember going on the Autobahn and you saying, oh, that's my hotel, as we went flying past. And ended up in Piance. And then It was a really good evening.
Thank you very much for taking me. That was an interesting evening with a lot of drinks and a lot of fun. No, but you guys were just so open-hearted and with open arms. It was one of the nicest job that I've ever done, because sometimes it's really difficult with a couple of your fellow actors and actresses, but that was really amazing. That's where we met.
Thank you.
14 years ago.
Yeah, we kind of always have taken that mentality, really. Whenever we were very lucky to be one of like the go-to guys, and I suppose we still are to a point, the go-to guys with the brand in terms of promotional side of things, because we would always be up for certainly the European legs of the promotional side of things. So we would go to territories that maybe wouldn't necessarily have the premieres, have like cast go to the premieres. And we would always make sure that one, we'd fulfill every commitment, what was put before us, like be it interviews, premieres, events and stuff like that. But we would always make the most of whatever, wherever we were, we wanted to see. I didn't want to see the inside of a hotel room. I wanted to see everything on
life.
Offer.
You wanted to enjoy life.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I remember going to, we were in Cologne for the traveling exhibition when that was there. And yes, we went there, we did the unveiling of the exhibition, which was, again, was kind of just on a stage, and then went from there to, I think we were there for like 2 days. So we did like the interviews, we did the press launch for it. And then we went to watch FC Cologne play, just to see, because we always made sure that if there was a sporting event on, I wanted to go and watch it or see what else is in the city. And we roped to it in Potsdam as well, because I'd never been to Berlin. So we stayed in Berlin at the time. So we went to Potsdam to do the events, and then we're able to go all around Berlin, which is really, really special to be able to do.
That's exactly how you should treat it when you go on a big tour and have a good time. Did you keep actually anything from set as a token, as a lucky charm? Or did you steal anything?
I think that's the most pressing. Did I steal anything? I took a bag from Weasley's Wisdom Wheezes, because I could get that very easily under my costume. But they were very hot on taking anything from... I always wanted the wand, what George had.
And you weren't allowed to take it.
Unique, and no, they wouldn't release any of it. So I've got the only things in my house I've got the bag from Wheezy's Wisdom Wheezy's, the joke shop, like two items from the Skybing snack box, what Fred and George sell, and George's prosthetic missing ear. Oh. I've got that as you do. I've got that on the wall in one of the rooms in the house. So it's quite nice to be able to have that type of thing. But I think other stuff I probably would never see. But I've got a deposit lockup, which I go to every now and then. And in there I've got like books which I've had signed from all the cast and stuff like that over the years.
Oh, so my goodness! And J.K. Rowling
Yeah. So I was actually going through it, and I remember from the I've got every character has signed my first copy of the first book, which is quite cool. As I say, I'll keep that in like a vault out the way.
And you need to, because it's probably one of the most sought after treasures in the world.
It probably would be. I mean, the trouble is, I went there a couple of months ago, and due to the lockdown, you couldn't go to it. Over here, and I got there and I totally forgotten my password to get in the thing, and the guy behind the desk, luckily he knows me, and he was like giving me hints on what it could be. I was like, not too sure.
You should write it down someplace. Have you written it down?
I've changed it to something definitely remember. Okay. So it's quite good, but even so, like, just being able to look at things like that. But at the same time, it's nice. I prefer photographs of things, really. Like, I've got quite a few photographs around the house of times when we were on, probably mainly not on sets, but offset, be it in the dressing rooms or playing cricket on Privet Drive or just random stuff like that is stuff that I suppose, if I'm being sentimental and thinking back of it, that's why I look at fondly. But
the other side probably the magic of shooting a movie like that, that, you know, these little moments in between, not on set when the light is perfect, but rather when you hang out, you know, having a drink, playing sports. I think that's probably something that catches you more, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'd definitely say so. Because we actually did a, I remember we were doing a night shoot, and Rupert and I went for a ride. We had these bicycles. No, sorry, Rupert had a Segway, and I had a bicycle.
Oh, I hate Segways. And
he had that to get around on set.
Okay.
And we went into the Great Hall, and that was really eerie, because there was no one around and it was still like lit slightly. And I remember walking in there and we were saying, this is really creepy actually. So I suppose that would be like, it would be walking around Hogwarts in the middle of the night with no one around. And that was just a bit like memories like that. I just think back to and think that's still very special. And it's stuff where I suppose you had to be there to understand it fully, but it was still, it's still great to be able to think about, and they're the things that I treasure more than any of it. And a bit like the promotional trips, I hold those memories of doing that just as highly as the films, because that's when you see the fan base's reaction to it. That's when you see the what it means to people to be part of it. And also, as I said earlier, like making the most of the opportunities to go to different places on the company credit card, being shown the best places, being shown the more unique places that you wouldn't necessarily learn about in a Lonely Planet book or something like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you walk away and you're like, that was incredible.
Yeah, and probably the fans. I mean, you were treated like pop stars. You still are. I mean, as you've been saying it, when you talk about Harry Potter, there's such a huge fan base still around the world. It must be really interesting to see it, you know, traveling from Germany to Japan to the States to South America, that everywhere your characters are so beloved.
Yeah, and that is really cool to me. Like, as you say, like I've got a cool little like a world map in my house with different arrows going to different places with a picture leading to it. And as you say, like there's literally loads of places on there that I've been to where people get it and they understand it. It means something to them. It's it was an escapism to them, be it it was a time in their life what they're reminded of or something like that. And that is something that's very unique and very special. I'm very happy to have been a part of that. And even now, like with some of the stuff that my brother and I have done since, is still retaining that as well. And having been able to speak to people and being able to have that connection with people all over the world, it kind of just, to me, it broadens my mind even more so that, you know, it's the world's full of some amazing people who have some great stories. And if we're just a small part in their happiness, then that's absolutely fantastic.
Before we jump from the past to the present, there's one last question about the Harry Potter word. You know, next to Daniel and Emma and Rupert, there were so many amazing other actors within the franchise, from you know, Maggie Smith to Gary Oldman to Alan Rickman. Is there this one actor or actress that you always were amazed by, you know, when they stood in front of the camera and off camera? Because I mean, Alan Rickman, what an amazing person, as far as I know from what I've seen and when I, you know, met him for interviews. What about him or Gary Oldman? Is there this one person that you always looked up to and really admired?
I think the funny thing is that when we first started filming, I certainly didn't know what to say to the older actors. You know, you were like, oh, wow. You've seen these guys in amazing stuff, and then seeing them actually do it firsthand, I was kind of in awe to just see what was what. But then the cool thing about it was that they would talk to you as your equal. Like, I can remember, as you say about Alan Rickman, like I remember on one of the films, it was his last day, and he'd just come out of the hair and makeup room without his wig on. And he said, well, I'm done for this one. I'll see you next year. And I remember just like thinking, yeah, okay, I'll see you then. And it was, that kind of just, I think it was probably on like the third one maybe or something. And that really just changed for me the approach to any of the older actors, because they just saw you as part of it. They saw you as
As you know, equals.
As an actor in it, yeah, as an equal. But I think one, if I had to pick one in particular, Julie Walters, because she was just how she, like the first day she was filming was, the first day we met her actually was on King's Cross platform on the first movie. And she came, the holding area was the train. So if you're looking at the platform where everyone's walking with their trolleys, you know, there's a train the other side of the platform, and that is where we were all, our waiting room was, as it were, before, while they were setting up the shots and things. And we were sat down in the carriage, and I just remember her shouting, "Where are the boys? Where are my boys? Where are my boys?" And she came in, and that was kind of exactly what you see is what you get with her. But she was great, and just watching how she did things, like before they'd start rolling, and you can kind of like take on board with that. And I remember in the last movie, I asked her advice on something I was doing in one of the scenes, and just getting her take on things was really, really cool. And just nothing but absolute respect and awe for everything that she does.
She's probably very heartwarming, very sweet, as you've been saying it and describing it. That makes it even better, isn't it?
Yeah.
To see someone as good as she is, and then knowing that she's not only a great actress, but also a very kind person. I think that's always what I'm afraid of, you know, that you are in awe of someone's performance and someone's acting skills and chops, and then you meet that person and they're not in, I don't know, they're not anywhere close to the person that you hoped they would be. And
exactly. I mean, just one example of like what she did. Like we were, James and I were going for an audition. No, we were doing a TV show, and we had to do a different accent. going back to accents again, and I asked Julie like any recommendations for it, and on the back of her sides, she'd left in my dressing room a whole list of numbers of dialect coaches to call.
Oh,
and just so, like just things like that, which
little things.
I mean, it just shows how welcoming and open it is, you know. And it was very, very special.
As I said, jumping from the past to the present, you are a part of Edgar Wright's very highly anticipated movie called Last Night in Soho, with Anya Taylor-Johnson, Matt Smith, Thomasin McKenzie. What can you tell us about it? I mean, because I saw the trailer, it looks intriguing, interesting.
Yeah, I can't believe we made the trailer, actually. I've got to be honest with you, it's a burst of bubble. We only did one day's filming on it, so I'm not too sure of how much we're actually in the final cut, but I was glad that we made it in, like, okay, in that scene anyway. So we literally saw the one page or the two pages of the scenes that we did, and that was it. So in terms
that was
of,
it.
That was it. The rest of the story, I couldn't tell you what happened or anything. All I remember is that we went for the audition, and James and I thought, right, okay, Edgar Wright, Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, it's going to be a comedy.
Oh, Shaun of the Dead, one of my all-time Baby Driver.
It's going to be a comedy. So we did it very comedic and get to laugh. And I said, all right. And then after the audition, I said, all right, so is it a comedy? And he went, no, it's a thriller. And we were like, oh, no, we're not getting this role. But luckily, we got a call back to do it again to do it a bit to see us again, and that was really cool. But yeah, I can't tell you a lot about the film because I don't know any more than what anyone else has seen in the, apart from the, as I say, the stuff that we filmed, but we were only there for a day or two, so we didn't really see, I'm not too sure how much of our stuff is actually in, certainly the bit what made it in the trailer, which is quite good when we're doing the cloakroom stuff, but other than that, I'm not too sure, unfortunately.
Okay, let's wait and see what comes out of it. But what is Edgar Wright like as a person?
Yeah, brilliant. Really, really interactive, very open about talking about it. And he was explaining to us about, you know, how he wanted to use identical twins for that role, almost like as an homage to the olden days of cinema. Because he was saying in a lot of his films he does that. If there's almost like a mirror image type thing, he'll try and get identical twins in it. So the scene where we're doing with the mirror sequence is mm-hmm. is in, is is back to there. But no, he was great, actually. As I say, and it was quite funny when we asked him, you know, oh, so I take it it's a comedy, and he said, no, it's really not. So he started laughing at that point. But then he was giving us some stories about old stuff where he's done back in the day as well. So, but no, just to be able to work with him was really, really great.
Are you guys always being cast as twins, or do you sometimes get casted as, you know, Ollie and James separately?
We have done stuff separately, which has been really cool. But I think sometimes, fortunately or unfortunately, some people just see it as we are a twin act. We are the two of us together, which is, yeah, I suppose you've got to be okay with them. You've got to accept it. I know that's it. And you make the best of what you can do. We actually were able to do a really great, it was almost like a teaser pilot that we filmed in Germany last year called I'm trying to think the exact title. It Wasn't Me was the name of it. And we filmed it in Hamburg. And the premise is basically there's a set of identical twins, and the one brother basically says to his other brother, basically convince him to be the alibi, and they go on this crime spree because you can't convict without a reasonable doubt, and if you're not too sure which one it is, you've got to let them both go. So it was a great premise, one I thought about many times. I thought you could get away with stuff if you did it like that, but just being able to film that was quite cool. It was totally different to anything we've done in Harry Potter. This is definitely much more sex, drugs and rock and roll. But it was just being able to spend a few days in Hamburg and filming out there and working with the team there. It was really, really enjoyable.
But you are still sticking to acting. I mean, that is what you like to do.
Yeah. There's the acting. Obviously, with stuff going on in the last year with studios and stuff shutting down, has made me get into other ventures. So James and I last year we started a podcast which we just finished out.
Normal Not Normal,
that's the one. Yeah, so we've that finished this latest season finished a couple of weeks ago, which went down absolutely fantastically. Again, going on to people all over the world, getting in touch, and it was nice just people getting in touch with me and just saying it was their escapism for whatever they were going through. We have two golden rules on the podcast, which is no religion and no politics talk, which is amazing how many arguments you can avoid by keeping those out of play. And it was great to be able to talk to different people about what their normality is.
Does it exist, normality, or is that just a claim?
I think it's just a perception. What everyone looks at someone else and they think, "Oh, what I do in this regard or that regard isn't normal," because normality is what you perceive as your constant, I suppose. Because that was something where I used to really struggle with, that notion of thinking that I'm not in a normal place, and
because of James, of your brother.
Well, because of that, because of being in the films, because of being in a semi-public eye or whatever, like there was all these things that would almost like build up and up and up, and in the end I started going to counseling for it, and that was one of the main breakthroughs I had, was there's no such thing. Like, my normality and your normality are totally different. Doesn't mean there's wrong in either one or right in either one. It is just what you perceive it. And once I broke through that notion, it was like just a whole cloud lift, I suppose, is one way of describing it. So that was one of the methods we thought of. Well, how can we get this out to the masses without sounding preachy, without sounding, you know, without sounding like it's all out there, almost like let people work it out for themselves, but guide it under that normal is not being normal. And that kind of resonates with a lot of people who've listened to the show, which has been really good.
And is it weird to be talking to your brother about these kind of things?
Yeah, I suppose it is, because we don't talk about that type of stuff. Probably even now we still don't, but we talk about it more on the show with the guests who we're talking to. Like, what is your normality? Like, what are you doing? Be it, we've had everyone from Mercedes Varnado, who plays the character Sasha Banks in WWE, to Ivana Lynch, who is in Potter with us. Who else have we had? And we've had like, there's a whole range of different people, like sports people, actors, businessmen, and just like gauging what their normality is. And that's the cool thing about it, is that there's at the end of the show, we basically wrapped it up with, well, that's their normal. Is that the same as your normal?
I think it's great because I think, no, you know what? I think that the most difficult thing for kids is that, you know, that there's a certain anticipation, a certain kind of pressure on them from society, what they have to do and what they have to be like and where they should go and what they should be thinking about. And as you grow up, you suddenly realize that there is no certain thing of behaving. You know, there is no, as you've been saying, is you don't need to be normal. Every and each individual person on the face of the earth can be and think and do whatever they want to, except hurting people and doing, you know, horrible crimes. But I think it's great that you guys are talking about it from your perspective and listening to the that other people can listen to what you are, you know, have to be working on and what demons you are fighting due to the fact that you have been thrust into this amazing career.
Yeah, and that's the in one way, it's amazing the amount of people who because I never really spoke about it at all publicly, and it was quite cool the response, because I remember thinking, well, you know, I used to go out literally with them. I suppose in an acting sense of you, like, you put a mask on, right? This is the perception that people want to see me in. That's what I'll do, even though inside you're probably not wanting to do it or you're whatever. And then once you kind of break through that notion of, well, it's okay to do what you do, as long as it's not the detriment to anybody else. And that's the important thing, I think. And that's the main cycle of it that we try and certainly live by. I mean, my wife is a way more calmer person than I am about a lot of things. So I would say I try and do as she does in a lot of ways, but she knows I'm not going to.
In what way? Are you
I'm a lot more, I suppose, confrontational. If somebody says something to me what I don't appreciate, I'll ask them why they did it. You know, I never used to be, but that's my coping mechanism with it. I'll say, why'd you say that? Like, I remember leaving a restaurant once, and this girl was there with her friend. They were probably in their late 20s. And the one friend was a massive Harry Potter fan. So we were talking with her, and the friend's going, I don't like Harry Potter. And I just said to this guy, I was like, why would you say that? Like, what have you gained from saying that? And you could see her almost get like, I don't know. I said, "What? Just think, why would you say that? You know, your mate's really excited to be chatting with us, and, you know, you're kind of raining on it.
Ruined it. Yeah, exactly. It made her feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it was, and why? It was like a, and afterwards, like, my pal was with me going, I can't believe you did that. And I said, why? She's been an idiot, like, just being rude. And it's, that is, as I say, that's kind of my thing. And the thing, what the character, I suppose I kind of play up to it a bit on our podcast, is that I go on a rant about random things every week. And it's,
And James has to tame you.
And James kind Calm of just down. Sits back and just lets me get on with it. Yeah. So I've got to be honest, I do exaggerate it a bit on the show. But again, that is one playing to the comedic effect of things, but also I think a lot of people go through these things in their head anyway, whether they say it out loud or not. Like, you'll be behind someone who goes to the self-checkout at the supermarket with, a, you know, 60 items, and in your head you're going, why are you doing it? You know? So you kind of like, I kind of like play it to that motion on it. But again, just being able to use this media that we can do and do this type of stuff at home, and being able to get it out to people has been fantastic. And that's been one of the highlights of the last year, where everyone's normality has kind of been thrown up in the air or put on pause or something. And yet we've been able to, I wouldn't say bridge a gap with that, but almost as a byproduct of us just putting a message out there. Yeah, putting it and enjoying it and getting people who get in touch and just saying, you know, there was this girl who got in touch and she sent me a message saying that her brother had passed away, and she listened to the show the day of it happening, and it totally transported her away just for that hour and a half or whatever it was from all the pain and everything else. And I don't care if it's an escapism for people. I'm quite happy that it is, because we kind of just try and, you know, I think everyone's grown up enough to know that there is bad in the world, but my word, there's far more good than there is bad. It's just a shame that people don't talk about the good stuff. So we try and just, you know, yeah, exactly. And that's, and a bit like we spoke about earlier, like you didn't have to, going back all those years ago when we were like, oh, do you want to come on the, yeah, come on, come to the club with us, come for a nice hour with us. And you didn't have to do that, but you being that open to new things, open to new people, open to new stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like that just shows the good that can come from things when you kind of just go with a good vibe.
Just to stick to that thought that we were just talking about, I think it's always important to remember, I don't know, we do not know what happens after death, but I think we all know what we could enjoy up until death. You know what I'm trying to say? This is the only life that we have. And as you've been saying it, you know, why does that person tell you that she doesn't like Harry Potter? It makes no sense. You know, it doesn't make her feel good. It doesn't make you feel good. It doesn't make her mate feel good. So why? There's so much good in the world. You know, either, you know, close your mouth, don't say anything about it. And good on you that you walked up to her and basically said, why do you say that? I think that's exactly what you should do.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly what people should do.
And I think even if on the offshoot of that is, even if that she had that opportunity again with somebody else, she wouldn't do that, you know, like,
yeah, because she learned.
Yeah,
she
that's learned. It. Yeah. And there's so much
from your response.
There's a lot being said that we live in a world where it's a lot easier. I suppose that maybe that's the offshoot of social media, where it's a lot easier to just fire off a negative comment, that sometimes people bring it into the real, you know, the real world, as it were, that sometimes that can happen. And, you know, no one gains from either of those things. So why do it? So I think that's the main thing, is that you can always get a bit more moany and stuff like that. As I say, I try and take a leaf as much as I can out of my wife, because she's the most placid going person. You know, I know if something's really bad, I know, because she'll mention it. Other than that, she kind of just keeps quiet. So I like to think we've got a good balance. She may say differently, but I like to think we've got a good balance with that type of thing.
And she challenges you. I mean, I think that's always important in a relationship.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. She definitely does that. I mean, the other day we were going through the calendar and she said, oh, you're playing golf again? Like, just that comment was enough for me to text my pal, I'm not going to make it tomorrow. You know?
Exactly. Sorry. I would love to, but I can't.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Ollie, let's play a little game.
Okay.
If you're up for it.
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to ask you a question and give you three answers, and you have to let me know which one you choose and why. Okay?
Okay, yep.
Let's get started. If you could choose a magic talent, which one would it be? A, being invisible. B, being able to see the future. C, being able to influence other people's thoughts and actions.
Ooh, can you do anything about seeing the future? Like, can you change the events, or does it just happen?
Oh, okay. Let me put it that way. No.
No, okay. I would...
oh, yes. Would that change your mind? You would probably go for B.
I'd go for B. If I could see the future and think I can do something to change that course of events. Yeah, I think I would do. Yeah.
Okay. And if you couldn't?
And if I couldn't, it would be C.
Influence other people's thoughts and actions.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. I remember the first Highlander with Christopher Lambert at the end, when he sits there and he looks over Scotland and he basically says, I can feel and read people's thoughts all over the world, from politicians to sports stars. I don't know what he says. I can't recall the right sentences, but I thought that would be so cool.
Yeah.
You know, to know what people think and basically take charge and change their thoughts and minds.
Yeah, because I mean, that's kind of what everyone wants to do anyway, isn't it? It's just a way of doing it. But if you could actually do it in a knowing, as you say, knowing what they're thinking to begin with anyway, that's quite, that'll be a powerful thing to be able to do.
Next one. A witch grants you the talent of becoming a famous sports star. Which sport would you choose? A, golf. B, football. Or C, Quidditch?
I think golf, definitely.
Is that your passion?
It is, yeah.
Are you an Aston Villa fan?
I am. I'm a big Aston Villa fan. So it would be, I think my chance of ever playing for the Villa are long gone, but it would be, Yeah, I mean they've been doing well actually. This last year they've turned it around from nearly getting relegated back to back out of the Premiership. So it's good that they're back in the Premier League, and it was nice. I was able to go to the last game of the season, which was the first with fans for about 13 months or something like that. So it was nice to be able to be back at Villa Park and watching them beat the now European champions in Chelsea. It was quite good watching them do that.
Oh, but why would you choose golf?
I think just because I always have a thing. I either, if I'm going away, if I can, I will always have my golf clubs with me. So if I could be that good to be able to do it anywhere and play at such a high level, it would probably be a lot more enjoyable, I think. That would be it. And I think it's the life goal. I think anyone who ever picks up a golf club always wants to be able to shoot scratch. That's like that's the end game, isn't it? So that would be it.
Okay, because I took a couple of golf lessons. I haven't been hit or bitten by the golf bug yet. But what is so great about golf? Because it's sports, it's focus,
it's kind of everything. Yeah, it's like it's competitive. It's the concentration skills side of it. It's the skill side of it. If you want to be good at it, it's the dedicational side of it. It's the technical side of it. It's probably one of the only games in the world where it's played more between the ears than it is anywhere else. And the great thing I love about it is that you can go, as I say, I've been lucky enough to play golf in a lot of different countries. And you just turn up at a golf course if you book the tee time, and you'll play with a complete stranger and spend 2, 3, 4 hours, however long it is, with that person or people, and just converse. Maybe stop and have a bite to eat and a drink afterwards, and then off you go. You may never see them again. You may keep in contact and meet up on golf trips again. But very rarely are you able to do that unless it's in that environment. And it's to me, it's a great thing. I think the European
Tour. Are you any good?
I'm doing better. So I joined a new golf course a couple of back last year, which is one of the better ones in England. And since joining there, the standard of the players is a lot higher. And yeah, I found that my handicap's down. I'm a single figure handicapper now, which I'm very proud of. But again, that goes down to the putting time into it and putting effort into it, which is good. So yeah,
you could still go down that career path. I mean,
going back to temperament, I think I'm too confrontational.
Okay.
I think I'd be too much like, oh, I'm not doing that again, you know. It's still not there. I've been trying very, very hard. But unless, maybe I should get sponsored by like a chamomile tea or some calming herbal thing or something like that. Yeah, that would be good, yeah.
Okay, number three. You could go with one of the following bands or singers on tour. They would all still be alive. Which one would it be? A, Queen, B, Metallica, C, Elvis.
Ah. Oh. That is hard. to go on tour with them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, hanging out with them backstage.
Oh, wow.
Singing a duet on stage if you want to.
I've been lucky enough to see Metallica probably about 7 times live.
Are they amazing?
And absolutely.
And Rock 'Em Ring. That was cool.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's probably Queen, though. I think Queen would have been the ultimate to be able to see Freddie Mercury do his stuff day in, day out.
What did you think of Bohemian Rhapsody?
I liked it. I liked it. I thought it could have been maybe a bit more gritty, but it was still great. I think the music in it is really good, but I thought certainly the Live Aid scene was done very, very well, even down to the detail in like the Pepsi cups, what they're using. You know, yeah. that type of level of detail I thought was really, really impressive.
Ollie, it's been so great talking to you. I mean, it took way too long until we had the chance to finally meet up again, just over microphones. And you are at the moment in Birmingham.
Yes.
I'm sitting in Hamburg. Yep. But thank you very much for your time. And hopefully I get to see you again soon. Whenever you're in Hamburg, please let me know and say hi to your brother and your lovely wife.
Will do. Thanks very much, Stephen. I really, really enjoyed it.
That was awesome. Thank you, Ollie.